Shrink Wrap Radio number 284, A Jungian Vision to Save the Planet, with Gene Shinoda Bolin, MD.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is noted author and Jungian analyst, Dr. Gene Shinoda Bolin. We'll be speaking about her 2011 book, Like a Tree, How Trees, Women, and Tree People Can Save the Planet. For more detail on her background, please visit our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Gene Shinoda Bolin, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. It's good to be with you, David.
Well, I'm sure you wouldn't remember, but you and I met years ago. At the time, you were married to Jim Bolin, and I was a book reviewer for New Realities, the magazine that he was editing.
That does go back, yeah, previous life.
Yeah, it does. I also had the opportunity to hear you give the commencement address a few years back at Sonoma State University, where I was a member of the psychology faculty, and I remember being very inspired by your talk and also feeling really proud that the commencement speaker was one of, quotes, our people.
Oh, that was great. That's also quite a number of years. That was quite a number of years ago.
Well, time flies by, doesn't it? It doesn't seem that long ago to me, but I'm sure you're right. Also, for many years, I taught a course at Sonoma titled Seminar on Myth, Dream, and Symbol, and your book, Goddesses in Every Woman, was on the list of recommended readings. I imagine many of my listeners will be familiar with it.
And Gods in Every Man, too. So I did pay attention to both the feminine and the masculine.
Yes, yes. Well, those have really become classics, I think. I've been reading your latest book, Like a Tree, How Trees, Women, and Tree People Can Save the Planet. And the book begins with a personal story involving the loss of a favorite tree. And maybe that's a good place for us to begin, if you wouldn't mind recounting it here.
Well, this particular book, Like a Tree, How Trees, Women, and Tree People Can Save the Planet, has as its whole title a very activist-sounding title.
Yes, it does.
And the writing of it was inspired by two events, or three events, really. One was the loss, after being an unsuccessful activist, to save the cutting down of a large Monterey pine tree in front of my house. And it happened when I was at the United Nations in New York for meetings around the Commission on the Status of Women. And at that particular meeting, I was on a panel with Gloria Steinem, and she's an old friend, and we talked about, you know, what was going on in our respective lives. And I told her about the saga of the tree, that when I came back home again, it would be cut down. And then I had tried for well over a year, close to a year and a half, to influence the homeowners association to not have this tree in its prime cut down. It was a political decision that had a lot to do with a new view created by the remodeling of the house next door, and that the neighbors wanted the tree down. Now, some people think that looking at a beautiful tree is a view, but unfortunately that was not the case in this case. And the other was then stirring up, because it was on commons property and not, I mean, though it's right in front of my house, this particular homeowners association has us owning the footprint practically under which our houses are, but all the land around our houses, more or less, is common, so that a decision to cut a tree down could be done by a vote. And this particular tree, a Monterey pine tree, happens to be a tree that is not fire resistant should my house catch on fire or should the whole hill catch on fire. And so a number of fears were brought into the equation as well. So Gloria says to me, after I hear the saga, she hears the saga, I tell the saga.
Yeah.
She says, remember, Gene, you are a writer, and writers can have the last word.
Good advice.
It was good advice. And the book turned out to be different in many ways. The more I got into the subject of trees, the more my wonder and appreciation for trees grew, the more the subject broadened out into sacred and symbolic and far out, for that matter. And as a tree became sort of rooted in my psyche and in my creative process, the book that could have been an angry book isn't at all. It has a quality of having been taught by the tree and the tree people of there's so many different things from indigenous. Well, the Jungian part is also part of this as well. It's the most far-ranging of all my books.
Yeah, it is very far-ranging, and it has a fascinating structure because each chapter, each chapter has a very evocative title, but then there are subsections. Each subsection is rather short, and there are all these subsections, and each one has its own subtitle that is a very interesting little subject in its own. And then, as you point out, the book is just very wide-ranging in terms of all that it embraces. Now, early on, you raised the question, what exactly is a tree? You know, which seems like a simple question in a way. And then you quote a delightfully humorous definition that a tree is a big plant with a stick up the middle.
Oh, I love how the English, that's, you know, the quotes that I have from English botanists and biologists are just so delightful because they not only love their subject, they have a way with words. So whenever I could quote somebody who could really say it well,
I did. Well, you go on to discuss the Carboniferous period in the Earth's development 350 million years ago. And I have to confess that I didn't even know that there was a Carboniferous period. What can you tell us about that period?
Well, what I do is give a really swift trip through the whole development of trees, which begins on a barren planet with algae at some point that is like a coat of paint on the otherwise sort of stony framework that is our planet. And then how that slime that is on the rocks can grow into nubbins of plant life and grow then taller and taller into ferns. And so from the Carboniferous period from 350 million years ago to 290 million years ago was a time in which we had these huge fern forests. I mean, forests covered the land on this planet much as if we were a tree forest, but it was all ferns, and they would come, you know, they would grow and collapse and grow and collapse and grow and collapse and grow and collapse, and under the pressure of everything that collapsed on top of them, we have the carbon source for coal and for oil. So, I mean, that's really down under this. But somewhere along the line, people think it maybe is 290 million years ago, nature ferns discovered the possibility of having a woody trunk with roots. And that made a very large difference. It was efficient, for one thing. The plant didn't just grow and collapse and grow and collapse and grow and collapse. It grew and it grew roots, and the roots would break up stone, and the leaves would create organic, more of the organic earth and all that we have come to have. And so when the leaves went up into the sky and did what leaves and plants do, which is to clear the atmosphere of the noxious gases that are in it and make it possible for the sun to reach the greenness, we have set in motion that which made it possible for there to be life on this planet, and eventually mammals who would breathe out the carbon dioxide that we breathe out and breathe in the oxygen that the green leafy trees provide us.
There's such a symbiotic relationship between the trees and us, isn't there? And going all the way back to the Carboniferous period that you spoke of, which provides us with all these carbon fuels that we have used prolifically, to this exchange of gases that makes it possible for us to live, to all the gifts that trees give us in terms of materials of wood and paper and so on.
You know, I just got into the wonder of trees, and it really began with a tree that was cut down. I had no idea that the tree was a particularly well-suited for where it lived, which is what trees do. This is a pine tree, a Monterey pine tree. It has needles. It doesn't have leaves. Well, I live in a place in Mill Valley that is fairly close to the ocean, and the fog belt comes in the mornings and some days, too. So who would have known that pine needles act as a distillery system? It takes the fog and it turns that fog into drops of water. And so the tree waters itself and everything in its environment. And so it's perfectly suited for the hillside on which it lived. And it maybe have been the first glimpse of, oh my goodness, this is amazing how the world of trees adapts to where it is and what it provided. I mean, it provided for me not only shade, but an ecological system that allowed some plants to thrive. And then when it was cut down, it changed the ecological system right around it. So I had this mini experience of what people talk about in a macrocosm about ecology and rainforest and things like that. And so I lead my readers through what I did myself, which was to learn for the love of learning and to keep having the sense of wonder grow.
Yes.
And that sense of wonder and a capacity to appreciate beauty and the whole structure of the book that you mentioned grows out of an appreciation of Carl Jung's notion of circumambulation. And when he uses the word that the point of our second half of life is to circumambulate the self, which is the center of meaning. So any symbol, and a tree is a symbol of the self, as I say somewhere else along the line. So to create a book in which in each chapter, we are going around the subject of the tree. We are circumambulating the subject, not in a linear way at all, but in this way of sort of seeing the tree from the many different aspects and appreciating the relationship that we have in our image life, in our sacred life, in our symbolic and dream life. I'm really sharing a kind of circumambulation trip with people, because that's how it was. I mean, that is it has that quality as I really enjoyed writing it.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you point out that the circumambulatory aspect.
Yeah.
That really makes sense, and I'm also now having the sense that the theme is the trunk, if you will, and all those subsections are the leaves of this kind of tree that you construct in the book.
Ah, wait a minute. Let's look more closely at the tree. Because the tree itself often has a root system that is as far branching and vast as the branches with the leaves above it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the tree is like a symbol of the shaman or the priest or the magician that, or the analyst that links the world of the mind or the world of the spirit with the world of the earth or the unconscious. And so the trunk, which you mentioned, is us. I mean, we mediate between the great above, the great below, sky father, earth mother, however you want to define it, the capacity to hold what could be called opposites, but when held is a picture of wholeness. This is why a tree becomes a symbol of the archetype of the self. This is why the tree shows up in people's dreams and mythology. It's a tree of life. It is the Bodhi tree. It's a Christmas tree, for that matter. I mean, there's the symbol of the tree just takes in the spiritual and the mental and the whole notion. One of the things I love about what a tree actually physically does, and I keep moving between the anatomical physiology of trees and the great meaning that it has. But on the anatomical level, to think that every little leaf, which may be like us, can transform sunlight or spiritual illumination into nurturing sugars that feed the whole tree. I mean, that little metaphor is just wonderful.
Oh, I love the way that you're bringing in all of this Jungian background, because really this show is, you know, a psychologically oriented show. And as you point out, your book covers not only the anatomy and physiology of trees, but also examines their role as archetypal and sacred symbols. So tell us more about that. We're just touching on some of that, and I love it. It's lyrical. Say some more about trees as archetype, for example.
Well, Jung has even a whole chapter in the collected works on the philosophical tree and its multiple meanings, because it has this capacity to link the above and the below, and it stands. I mean, the image of the priest is like the trunk linking, or the shaman linking above and below.
Mm-hmm.
But also, if you know, Jung has been often identified with the mandala,
yes,
as a symbol of the self, where you have a center and rings growing out from it. And that is what a cross-section of a tree looks like.
And, so, and often in the Myth Dream Symbol class, I would have students do some artwork, and often they did mandalas. And I would say that the image of a tree was maybe one of the most frequent images to come up that people would build into their mandala, with the, as you mentioned, the tree, the trunk in the center, and the roots reaching up, the branches reaching up and the roots reaching down. And so clearly there is something very archetypal there emerging in students' imagination.
Oh yes. That's what an archetype image is. When we turn to musing about how do we create an image that speaks to us of our capacity for depths and for heights and the realization that we go through the seasons. I mean, we have the trees in its many seasons, representing spring, summer, autumn, and winter. And Hildegard of Bingham has a whole collection of her paintings, drawings with the seasons of our lives represented by the tree and its many, you know, first its green buds in spring, and then its full greenness, and then its fruit bearing, and then when it loses its leaves and goes to seed, and the seeds go into the earth to await spring. I mean, there's a whole there's that all of the things that trees do so resonate with our sense of our nature and nature being related, and it being symbolically something about immortality as well, because when we think of family tree, it is connected with our connection. We are just like one branch or one twig to the human, well, to our specific family tree, which may be the equivalent of a branch, but then it ties into all that evolutionary humanity tree, which grows out of the roots of all of what came before us. So tree represents, and in so many ways, tree is a tree of life as a symbol. And it has been considered that in such mythologies as the world ash tree in the Nordic world. And I just love the image of tree in the movie Avatar, for that matter, that this is what an archetype is. Now, not everybody taps into this level of meaning, and that is what was the definition for me of tree people. I think that a tree, what I observed in the political activism of who cares about whether a tree is cut down or not.
Yes, I was going to ask you what you meant by tree people, because it's right there in the subtitle of the book.
Well, the question about who cares defines the difference. I mean, for a tree person, a tree is living. It has its own beingness. Usually the tree person was a kid who climbed the trees, whose imagination was nurtured in a tree or under a tree, or as a young person sat and drew a tree and realize its beauty, and as an adult notices trees and cares about specific trees or trees in general, and might be a person who goes inward by going outward into the woods, like Muir Woods locally as I do, or up in the mountains. There's something about being related to trees, really using the word related, that there is a kind of sense that I'm a human being and that's a tree being, but we are here on this planet together and appreciate, I as a human being appreciate you as a tree being, especially if you're gorgeous and ancient and
okay. Yeah. I guess I'm a tree person because as you talk about, you know, the young kid climbing trees, that certainly was an important piece of my life. And I've planted trees as an adult by the house where we live. And the trees grow so slowly at first, and then suddenly they take off and you realize, oh my goodness, I didn't realize the power of the tree and how large it would become. And perhaps I've planted it too close to the house. And then there comes a time, unfortunately, as a homeowner, we've had to remove some trees.
Right.
And that's always a painful process. I don't like having to take out trees.
Well, that's because you're a tree person.
Yeah, now, I think so.
If you were a not tree person, for one thing, it's just a thing. Its value is, if it's a particular kind of tree, the number of board feet of lumber that it represents. So that when, for example, we had all of the Humboldt County demonstrations after Pacific Lumber Company sold its vast ancient redwood forest to a Texas company called Maxim, and Maxim's owner came in and just wanted to, and did, clear cut, because these ancient redwoods had represented a lot of money in redwood board feet. And that's when so many people did demonstrate, and that's when Julia Butterfly Hill became famous, because she started out as an activist that just came along with friends who were going up there to demonstrate. And then she became somebody who climbed up in the tree because that's what other people were doing so that they wouldn't be cut down. And then it's like one day at a time, one step at a time, she becomes the symbol of resistance to cutting down the trees. And she actually lives in a tree that she names Luna, for a few days over 2 years.
Wow.
And amazing. I mean, and so one of the things about this book is that I am talking about activism and how one becomes an activist one step at a time often, that you don't start out intending to be in a tree for 2 years. Whoever would, you know?
Now, one doesn't think of a Jungian analyst in this sort of an activist context somehow. It's more the image of the cloistered introvert that comes to mind. And I know you've gotten involved with the UN. How did that come about?
One step at a time activism. I mean, this is also a book to recruit activists, which is the same as having people recognize their personal myth or individuation. I mean, they fit together so well for me. So even though I talk about the anatomy and the physiology in the beginning chapter, I also put into that beginning chapter something of what I want people to respond to, which has to do with things will come along that call you to be involved, to speak up. And if it does, there's a feeling that maybe it has your name on it. It's an invitation, or I call an assignment, that you can say no to. But when it has your name on it, then it fulfills certain criteria, which I call, one, is it meaningful? You know, this is very Jungian. Meaning is the essence of what it is to me to help people to discover their personal myth. What's meaningful to you? And it always grows out of your natural talents and gifts and the suffering and difficulties that you've overcome, that you came into this world and you encountered in your family or whatever happened to you.
Yeah, I'm thinking of Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey and The Call. And in a way, that sounds like what you're talking about in terms of maybe being called, something in your life is calling you to be more activistic.
There's a similarity. There's also something of a difference, I think, because when I say something comes along that is your assignment, first, it's meaningful. Second, the question is, will it be fun for you? And fun means that it taps into what you can do, who you are, what you've already done, and your expression of yourself. It's fun to express yourself, and it's fun to do it with like-hearted people with the similar values that you do. So, and the third is a whole, whatever you're up to, motivated by love. And so I'm saying to potential activists, if something comes along and you can say of it, it's meaningful, it'll be fun, and it's motivated by love, then it may be not only your assignment in the sense of making a difference to your family, your organization, or the world, but it takes you into your individuation, your personal myth. So that's where Campbell and I come very close together in recognizing that we have, when you live meaningfully, you are living your personal myth. And that definition. Now, the reason I say it's a little different is that the heroic journey often is a call to adventure. And I have, in my own way of looking at things and writing about things, I've differentiated the heroine's journey from the hero's journey and saying, in a sense, that one is a call to adventure. So I do the hero's journey when I go to medical school, called to be a doctor. That's heroic sort of stuff. A heroine's journey is to step by step do what you didn't want to have happen to you. To do, it's the psyche myth. It's the myth in which you don't know that you have the ability to do the next step. It's not a challenge to you to do it. It's like, what else can you do? And in the process of what else can you do but take one step and then the next step, and maybe the next beating, maybe the next pain, maybe the next whatever it is, maybe the next descent, you gradually discover a strength or a source or the heart in yourself that makes you grow, and you are on a heroine's journey. I think that so many women who take up the cause of a child are, for example, or have a child after a rape or something like that, it isn't something that you went out to do. But here it is. And will you open your heart? Will you take on the day-to-day unglamorous? I mean, I think the heroine's journey has a lot to do with that, which is not looking very heroic at all. It has to do with the day after day after day, because you have made a commitment to this child, to this patient, to this organization, to this cause, and it isn't glamorous at all, but it is meaningful, and it is motivated by love. And it turns out to have its high points. Wouldn't say it's fun in overall, like raising a child. It isn't always fun, but sometimes it's absolutely joyful, and the other times it's absolutely drudgery. Mm-hmm. You know, this is life. So which is your story? I mean, we can be on a hero's journey for part of our lives, and then what might be called a heroic. I actually then call it heroic versus heroic.
You talk about the girl effect, and that might be relevant here. Tell us what you mean by the girl effect.
Well, this brings us into what I do at the United Nations with the commission on meetings around the Commission on the Status of Women, and my efforts as a primary advocate for the United Nations 5th World Conference on Women. It's to realize that you can look, and this to go back to actually the beginning, when I went to the Commission on the Status of Women and my tree was going to be cut down while I was away, I realized that when you treat trees and girls and women as property over which you can do whatever you want to do with them, then what happens is like what happens to girls who are sold, who are trafficked, who can have miserable lives because at some level they can be used to pay off a debt, they can be used to make money, and they're treated like a tree that is a source of lumber. And the people who deal, who traffic in girls or trees with no concern over qualities such as beauty or soul or sacred or any of those sorts of things, are in worst case the element of not tree people, because a tree person feels a connection with life in general, with the planet in general, has a sense of soulfulness. Now, you can start with a sense if you want to rescue girls from bad things that are happening. You know, and rape in certain parts of the world is used as a military way to humiliate your enemy. I mean, girls and women are caught in an enormous, awful crossfire. And when I go to the UN, what I realize, I am appalled. I would not be there but for the little book I wrote called The Man's Circle. It's sort of the book led the way to me getting involved with the UN. So I'm at the UN, and we don't get much news from the UN. I am appalled what I hear, and I am inspired by what I hear, because I see these presentations are being made by women on the ground in NGOs, many of whom went through the rape or that got away from the trafficker or whatever she did, and together with other women are making a difference to the lives that they touch. So I start to see that. I start to learn about programs like the Girl Effect and appreciate that Nike is actually behind the financing of the Girl Effect, which has grown out of what NGOs have realized, that when you educate a girl, the influence that she has on, it's not just on her life, but she will, when she has children, it will be later. She'll have fewer children. She'll see to it that they're nourished and educated. She will work, and 90% of what she brings in when she works goes to her family and benefits her family in the village. And it's something I'd learned previously about these micro loan things, that when they loan money to men and women alike, what happens is the men spent the money on themselves impressing other men and didn't pay the loans back as a gender, as a group. Well, women, as a gender, as a group, use the money to, say, buy the goat that could provide the milk and provide nourishment and also a source of income, or buy the sewing machine, and would give the money back. And so microcredit loans now go about 95% to women, not out of bias, but out of experience. And what they've learned about girls is the same thing, that see, education of a girl brings much more benefits to the family and the village than educating a boy.
Yeah, I'm a micro lender myself, I might add, not on a huge scale or anything, but I belong to Kiva and another micro lending organization. And I have to say that I have favored women and girls just for the reasons that you're articulating.
I mean, it's inspiring to see what can be done with so little sometimes.
Yes, yes, it really is.
And the Girl Effect is dedicated to sort of letting the world know that there is this benefit when you educate a girl.
Yeah. I'm also remembering Craig. I'm blocking on his last name. Craig right now there's some controversy, but the fellow who's built the mountain climber who's built all these schools in
Mortensen.
Yes, Craig Mortensen. And I believe he was also guided by that principle that it was important to educate the girls.
Yes, he was building mostly schools for girls.
And you know, coming back to Jungian analysis, I'm wondering, Arth, if there is a way in which the global crisis, or what we've been talking about in terms of trees, where does that have a place where it articulates with the analytic or therapeutic process in terms of maybe coming up in dreams or how you might respond to dreams or imaginal material?
Well, what I'm doing is different than we usually look at Jungians as doing. Jungians do have a deserved bias, a reputation towards being introspective, introverted, intuitive, and not activist necessarily in the world. Once you bring in that there are different psychological types and bring in the idea that meaning is at the center of an authentic life, which is what individuation is about, and that's what we as Jungian analysts do, then we see people normally off who are in the second half of life when the question comes up, is this all there is? You know, I've done what I was supposed to do. And there's an emptiness here. There is something at the soul level that wants to do more or learn more or go inward in some way. Now, I'm saying that you go inward and sometimes discover that in the inner places of yourself, that there is a time to then go out, that there is, I think, within all of us, like, first of all, I use the metaphor of the heart a lot. I am a heart-connected activist. All of my activism comes through, like, circles with a spiritual center, which is a mandala. And I started to say that the only reason I'm at the UN at all was because I wrote this little book called The Mayan Circle, the first of the activist book, and that it had as a subtitle, How to Transform Ourselves and the World. And it was based on an appreciation that Jung's collective unconscious and Rupert Sheldrake's morphic field theory were the same thing, only Jung, in his description of the collective unconscious, gives the impression that it's a fairly static thing, that the archetypes remain as potential and don't change necessarily over the years, et cetera, et cetera. So it lends itself to a much more be in inward now kind of attitude. Now, Rupert Sheldrake is a theoretical biologist, has even written in a Jungian journal that the human morphic field, and each species has its own morphic field, is Jung's collective unconscious. And his theory allows for, explains why animals adapt, change, and therefore change their relationships with each other and their society. And so I saw that, and I also experienced how our culture changed when a critical mass or a tipping point was reached. So whether I use Rupert Sheldrake's notion and then bring in the morphic field, which is what I first did with the Mayan Circle, and then it attracted some women who were involved and seen that the vision I was describing, which was to take the story of the 100th monkey, which was the story that inspired the anti-nuclear proliferation activists to keep on working to stop the arms, nuclear arms race between the superpowers when everybody else says you're ridiculous. How can you, as mere citizens, think you can affect the arms race? And these people did because they used Rupert Sheldrake's theory and the story that was allegorical. It's on the web sometimes as debunked because it wasn't true, because it was an allegory, but it made intuitive sense that when a certain number of a species learns to do something new, then suddenly something that was resisted becomes what everybody now accepts. And as soon as you think historically, you realize that's true, that every major change has been like that. And if you are working at changing the world at the beginning, it's as if you're doing this, and this is absurd, but when it starts to bring other people in, what you know is that the 100th monkey is a phenomena, or the millionth circle is the circle with the spiritual center, feminine form, feminine principle. It is the circle that when it is form ends patriarchy, because there no longer will be an entirely patriarchal world. There will be a tension, a balance, or an integration of the circle with the hierarchy. And that's a Jungian way of looking at things.
Yes.
And so I wrote The Mayan Circle. It went as a little book to South Africa, to the World Parliament of Religions. It went from there to Geneva, you know, carried as an idea by the women who were there, and came back to Northern California, where I was called up by a woman I had never met, who told me about how she and others wanted to start an organization based on my book, and could they use the name, and would I be willing to be involved in the organization of it? And that's what started me, because I went to that meeting. There were women there who were involved at the UN, and we had from the very beginning in the intention statement that we wanted to see circles adopted within the UN and the NGOs of the UN.
Maybe there's starting to be a growing movement among Jungians toward psychoecology. You may be aware that the Asheville Jung Center is sponsoring a video presentation from Zurich tomorrow, as it happens, by Murray Stein and Brigitte Eger, and is titled Energy, Ecology of the Psyche and the World. And unfortunately, our interview will come out too late for listeners to participate, but I'm pretty sure they could purchase a DVD by going to www.ashevillejungcenter.org. Are you aware of that work by Brigitte Eger, PhD? I think maybe her doctoral dissertation and Jungian work has centered around these sorts of concerns.
I haven't been aware of her, but I was told about her in the past about 10 days or so because of this program, and I've heard good things about her.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't be surprised if she cites you, that you kind of got one of the first monkeys.
Well, I think she must have been long before, because this, I think, must have been part of her thesis work.
Okay.
In Zurich, while my book just came out on Earth Day in 2011.
No, but I'm thinking about the earlier Circles book that you were talking about.
So that could be. It could be. It also could be.
Yeah, you could be the first monkey. At first blush, trees, women, tree people, girls, archetypes, and symbols seem like such disparate topics, but you really, you tie them all together.
Yeah,
so
I do.
As we kind of wind down here, what would you say is the common thread that ties them all together?
I think it has to do with human beings being able to be connected and have a sense of sort of indigenous wisdom or oneness. I mean, my own journey has been like that. I start out writing about synchronicity and the Tao of psychology. And the Tao and the indigenous idea of the great mystery is really pretty much the same. And the notion that we are all related and that all life and the planet itself are that we have these connections, that's Jung's synchronicity is requires that we accept an interconnected universe. And so I think that whether we are, it really isn't a stretch, is what I'm trying to say. It when you see things as disparate, it seems like, how is that related to that, or to that, or to that? But once you drop down deeper into the psyche that isn't just in our brains, but is something invisible, energetically carrying images, responsible for evolutionary thought changes and things like that, then all of this, trees, people, planet, activism, we're all related.
Jean, that's a great place for us to wrap it up. Dr. Jean Shinoda Boland, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, you're welcome. This has been far-ranging indeed.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Jean Shinoda Boland. In addition to the book we discussed here, she's written quite a few others. I would invite you to use the Amazon link on shrinkwrapradio.com to see if there are other titles that you'd like to own. I was having a little difficulty catching the first word of one of the titles that she mentioned several times. I went on Amazon, and I now see that the title was The Millionth Circle, How to Change Ourselves and the World, The Essential Guide to Women's Circles. I was surprised to hear of her friendship with Gloria Steinem. I knew that Gloria Steinem was an important figure in the women's movement, but I didn't really know much else about her until I saw a recent hour-long profile on HBO. I must say I was quite impressed. She was a beautiful young woman who in the 1950s was also a journalist and had great difficulty being taken seriously, which made her mad enough to later found Ms. Magazine, which turned out to be a major game changer. I would have liked to ask Jean more about her relationship with Gloria Steinem and how they met and became friends, but I was worried that that might take us too far off topic. Still, I do wonder. I'm sure there must be a good story there. In this interview, I especially liked Jean's version of the difference between the hero's journey and the heroine's journey. My guess is that many of my women listeners will resonate with that as well. Also, I think that Jean's passionate activism may help to round out our view of Jungian analysts, breaking some of the narrow stereotypes we might have had. If you'd like to find out more about Dr. Jean Shinoda Boland, her writing, speaking engagements, and work, she has a website at www.jeanboland.com.
I've been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long. Just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet, and he plays it so warm. Shrink Wrap Radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking Shrink Wrap Radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
Hey, happy Friday, all of you out there in Shrink Wrap Radio Land. Well, let's see. By way of new announcements, first of all, there is a new interview up at wisecounselpodcast.com, and you'll find both the audio and the written transcript of my interview with Diana Foscia, PhD, on Accelerated Experiential Dynamic Psychotherapy, otherwise known as AEDP. She's the founder and director of the AEDP Institute in New York City. With an interest in phenomenology of experience, she's on the cutting edge of transformational theory and practice, and she's changing the way we think about change. She's opening up exciting possibilities for what can happen in psychotherapy. So if you're interested in psychotherapy approaches, you'll definitely want to check this one out. Also, we have a new transcript on the site, I'm happy to announce. I want to thank Emily Humphreys for transcribing number 278, The Use of Active Imagination in Jungian Sand Play with Maria Hess, PhD. You know, it's occurred to me to wonder if the transcription process might be made easier by using Drag and Dictate. I don't have a copy of that program, but if there's a listener out there who does, I'd be interested in seeing the result using that to transcribe only the interview part of a show. And then without cleaning it up, just send me the transcript that Dragon produces so I can see how close it comes. If it does a good enough job, it might be that I could purchase a copy and then mail out a Dragon Dictate version of an interview to a volunteer for cleanup, and it might make the volunteer's job easier. I'm not sure, but it would be a good thing to explore, I think. Also, while I'm thanking folks, I want to thank listener Harry Parshall, who let me know that I could send him a referral for the Dropbox app. He's the only person who responded to my plea, and it enabled me to get an extra 250 megabytes of free storage. So if you don't mind me referring you to Dropbox.com and you're willing to download and install the Dropbox application on your computer, please drop me an email. Dropbox is free. It's very popular and widely used, and it lets you store files in the, quotes, cloud and move them between your various computing devices and smartphones and iProducts and so on. I find it really essential. I also want to announce an update on the continuing education front. The third Jung course has gone up on our site for 7 CE continuing education units. And even better, there's now a 20-unit Jungian CE package, that's all three courses, that you can get for only $149. That's a savings of $59 and brings it to less than $10 for a continuing education unit. And I'll have more Jungian courses on the way as time goes by. I'm told that our iPhone and Android apps are coming along, and I look forward to the day that I'll be able to announce those. Yesterday, I spent hours trying to get the background noise of a lawnmower off the soundtrack of an upcoming interview. I finally succeeded after a number of tries, but it was frustrating to burn so much time in the process. I pass the story along to you just to underscore how much more effort goes into the production of these episodes than you know about. So if you haven't clicked on the big green donate button at shrinkwrapradio.com, and you can afford to do so, please help to support this effort. And I thank you.
Hi, this is Patricia Damery, Jungian analyst and author, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Patricia Damery, who will be my next guest, and I'll say more about her in a bit. But first, let's go to some recent email comments from our listener community. First, we hear from Ruth in London, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I really enjoyed your interview number 275, Understanding Laughter as Medicine, with Dr. Madan Kataria. It really did make me laugh in parts. Anyway, I've been writing a blog where I summarize everything I learned from my reading and courses and podcast listening, and am planning on writing an entry on this episode. The blog is just an amateur personal reminder of ideas I come across. You can find it here. The link is ruthgutteridge.blogspot.com. But I'm planning on reviving it and integrating it into my website soon. Anyway, I would like to volunteer to transcribe podcast number 275, if it's available, as I will need to listen to it again anyway. And by the way, it is available, and I have signed Ruth up for it. She goes on to say, I currently work as a volunteer hypnotherapist in an HIV clinic and am thinking of trying out the laughter yoga as described by the giggling guru in your podcast with a group of users there. If it's not available to transcribe, do let me know which others need doing, and I will see if I can find another one to do instead. As an aside, when you were talking about the last time you were laughing when you shouldn't, it reminded me of an incident 2 years ago. I was on a 4-day shiatsu residential retreat, and one of the days we had a 24-hour silence. In the evening, we were exchanging treatments, about 16 of us all in one room in silence. My partner and I were at the end of the room, near the kitchen, when suddenly we started to hear the conversation of the kitchen staff. We were in the country, so that the broad country accents, and she's talking about the English countryside here, and their conversation went something like this. Person one, he's a lovely boy, a great catch. Person two, oh, really? Person one, oh, yes, is your daughter looking? Person two, how many cows does he have? Person one, quite a few. He has pigs, too. And they continued on in this vein for about half an hour, which with us coming from London was the most bizarre conversation we could have heard at the end of our 24-hour silence. We were in hysterics, but we had to hold it in as the rest of the room were all deadly serious. And as we all know, suppressing laughter makes it even funnier. It was so painful to keep it in. And then one of us farted, and we could no longer keep the laughter suppressed. Our colleagues on the course just thought we were a bit immature by ruining a silence just by laughing at a fart. It was probably one of those had-to-have-been-there moments, but it's a great memory to have, as it always makes me smile when I recall it. Good laughter is so precious. Yours, Ruth. Ruth, thanks for sharing that story. I got a laugh out of it. I hope other listeners did too. And thank you so much for volunteering to transcribe Dr. Kataria's interview. And that sounds like very interesting work that you're doing as a volunteer hypnotherapist with the HIV community. So keep up the good work all around. Next, we hear from Jeff, who is also stepping forward to do some transcription. Yay! Jeff writes, Dave, if you don't already have a volunteer, I'll transcribe the latest with James Fadiman. I can't figure out why the transcription didn't come to mind as a way to support Shrink Wrap Radio before. The light bulb popped on when, after hearing Dr. Fadiman mention a website and promptly forgetting it, I went to your site to find the link, but it wasn't there. But he did go back and find the link, and the link that he's referring to is http://entheoguide.net/wiki/main_page. Entheo Guide, that's entheoguide.net. He says, a couple of suggestions for your consideration. Would it be possible to include a link section in each show's notes? I haven't thought this one through, so there may be reasons why you can't or shouldn't be done beyond the work of documenting and including. His next suggestion is move the volunteers' names to the bottom of the transcriptions page or even link to a separate page. This is a way to pay you back or help you share the load. So I would not expect and would not really prefer not to receive public acknowledgement. It's a small gift I can give to you and the universe for all you've given to me. And the suggestions are made in all humility. Shrink Wrap Radio has had a profound positive influence on my journey. I will be forever in your debt. Well, Jeff, thanks for volunteering to be a transcriber of the episode with James Fadiman. I haven't heard much back from people about that one, by the way, so it's good to hear from you about it, and really happy that you're going to transcribe it, and I'm sure Dr. Fadiman will be pleased as well. And I appreciate your suggestions. I probably don't want to go to the bother of figuring out everything to link to in the show notes, so I'm don't plan to move ahead with that one, at least right now. But I liked your suggestion of listing the volunteer transcriptionists on a separate page. And so I've done that. If you're a transcriber, you will now find yourself listed and acknowledged on a separate page. Finally, we hear from Brian, who writes, Dear Dr. Dave, I have been catching up with missed episodes of Shrink Wrap Radio and was delighted by the interview with David Eagleman. I have yet to find Dr. Eagleman's book, Incognito. Well, you could order it from Amazon on our site. Hint, hint. I spent 50% of my time in India, he goes on to say, the rest in Australia, and have been wondering about the psychology of poverty. Obviously, brain function is affected by social and even nutritional factors. Is there any research on how psychology can be used to help people rise out of adversity? I've seen many make incredible changes with India's economic boom. Daniel Locke's India Express begins with a delightful story of a iron walla who proudly pays back loans he took, which many expected would never be repaid, to see his son's software trained. Still, I have also seen the challenges. On the one hand, many are tough, stubborn survival entrepreneurs of 10 on one-acre farms, as described by Paul Pollock, What Works When Traditional Approaches Fail, who finds ways to make small-scale economics profitable simply by finding out what people say they need, which is often different than an expert opinion. This is counterbalanced by demands for reservations of school, education, or political places for the disadvantaged, in part a product of post-colonial democratic socialism. Actually, the problem seems so diverse and far more complex social and historical forces. Still, I wonder if you have an opinion as to how best to help people grow and achieve when their environment daily weighs its message of poverty onto the unconscious. Let me just insert here that one way that I try to do that is by supporting microloans. And so I make microloans through a couple of services to India and other third world countries. And I think particularly supporting women in third world countries in that way, since women then in turn help to support the whole family. So that's one thing that can be done that personally I believe in. Brian goes on to say, I'm presently reading Down to This, A Year Living with the Homeless, Shaughnessy Bishop Stahl, which describes the dehumanizing effect of street life in Canada. Compare that to the 80,000 families living at Mumbai's airport slum. I do wish to emphasize that the many wonderful manifest beauties of the subcontinent. My Indian friends, especially the Western educated friends I live with in Maharashtra, who adopted over 40 orphans over the 2004 tsunami, often feel the good is lost or overwhelmed by gut-wrenching media coverage of poverty. Can psychology be used to help change disadvantage? I'm trying to piece together the opinions of as many thought leaders as possible. Do you have any ideas or know anyone who I could ask? Thank you so much. I'm particularly enjoying catching up with the show, and I will be back in India in a few weeks. I'm extremely grateful for your show, and that's from Brian. Brian, that's certainly an important issue that you raised, and I wish I had more information for you. By the way, I mentioned microloans, and I was temporarily blocking on the name of the two groups that I contribute through. One is can be found at kiva.org, and the other is vitana.org. That's V-I-T-T-A-N-A. And Kiva is K-I-V-A.org. I think both of these organizations are doing really good work. And so one way that you can look at making contributions to Shrink Wrap Radio when you click on that big green donate button is to know that your money in all likelihood is also helping to support those two organizations. Now, Brian, another resource that I would recommend to you is Dr. Robert Biswas-Diener, who I interviewed on Shrink Wrap Radio number 270, titled Unlocking Psychological Wealth with Robert Biswas-Diener, Ph.D. And Robert has traveled around the world looking into happiness in various countries, studying that. And in the process, of course, has come across a lot of poverty and has given thought to the issue that you're raising, and I'm sure could refer you to other resources. So if you listen to that show, I think you'll hear some contact information there. He does have a website, and you'll be able to track him down. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember, in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Jean Shinoda Bolen, for sharing her work with us on a Jungian vision for saving the planet. My next guest will be Patricia Damery, who is an analyst member of the C.G. Jung Institute of San Francisco and is in private psychotherapy practice in Napa, California. We'll be talking about her process of initiation into the worlds of Jungian analysis, shamanism, and biodynamic farming. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.